Today is Wednesday, October the 30th. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Hurricane storms Helene and Milton have destroyed whole communities in the southeastern United States. You can make a difference. There are still many people in recovery mode. You can play a vital role in helping those affected to recover and rebuild their lives. Your donations to the Red Cross will help deliver essential services and supplies to those in need. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. NSA tells iPhone and Android users, reboot your smartphone on a weekly basis. Details of new security recommendations were issued by the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, along with details of the U.K. government Cyber Essential schemes. The National Security Agency told all smartphone users to reboot on a regular scheduled basis. If you follow that advice, will you be safe from malware and spyware in 2024 and beyond? The NSA's original warning was published in a mobile device best practices guide in 2020. With smartphones running across all operating system platforms becoming an increasingly popular target for threat actors of all flavors, the NSA said that many of the features provide convenience and capability but sacrifice security, and attempted to pin down simple steps that even the most non-technical users could take to better protect their devices and data stored within. The document NSA has published is presented in such a way as to be clear to all audiences. Taking a pictorial approach, the NSA used an icon-based warning system informing readers that what they should avoid, disable, do, and not do. The do list includes using strong pins and passwords, biometric locks, and regular software updates, for example. The do not advice covers rooting or jailbreaking your phone, clicking unknown links, or opening unknown attachments. But it's the disable icon that drew interest most, especially when it came to disabling power by turning the device off and on again on a weekly basis. The second page of the infographic-heavy advice document took more of a tabular approach to warning smartphone users of things they should be doing regarding threat mitigation. This time, the iconography was divided between sometimes prevents and almost always prevents. When regularly rebooting your smartphone, the recommendation was to use it as it sometimes prevents spear phishing and zero-click exploits. It was never, therefore, a silver bullet solution or a one-size-fits-all security panacea. Meta confirms Instagram reduces video quality for posts that are not raking in views. And the best quality goes to the creators who drive more views. Instagram head Adam Mosseri shares some insights into why some videos on the platform appear reduced in quality well after they're posted, and it all boils down to performance. Responding to a question about old stories looking blurry in highlights, Mosseri said, "In general, we want to show the highest quality video we can, but if something isn't watched for a long time, because the vast majority of views are in the beginning. We will move to a lower quality video. The video later spikes in popularity again, then we will re-render the higher quality video. Further elaborating in a follow-up reply, though, Mazzieri added, we bias to higher quality, which is more CPU intensive encoding and more expensive storage for bigger files, for creators who drive more views. The comment has sparked concern from small creators in the replies who say it puts them at a disadvantage competing with others who have larger platforms. Meta has previously said it uses different encoding configurations to process videos based on their popularity as part of how it manages the computing resources. The performance system works at an aggregate level, Mazzieri said, not an individual viewer level. It's not a binary threshold, but rather a sliding scale, in response to one user who questioned its fairness to smaller creators. Mazzieri said the quality shift doesn't seem to matter much in practice as it isn't huge, and viewers appear to care more about video content over quality. Quality seems to be much more important to the original creator who's more likely to delete the video if it looks poor than to their viewers, he said. Understandably, not everyone seems convinced. Microsoft is forced to halt the Windows 11 24H2 update on some PCs. Microsoft's recent Windows 11 24H2 update is off to a bumpy start. According to users, are facing compatibility issues across various hardware and software configurations, prompting the company to temporarily block the update for some devices. The affected systems include specific ASUS laptop models and configurations involving software like VoiceMeter, Safe Exam Browser, and older versions of Easy Anti-Cheat, commonly used in gaming. Additionally, compatibility issues have arisen for devices with Intel Smart Sound technology drivers, integrated cameras, fingerprint readers, and customization tools like wallpaper apps. PCs that rely on audio processing through VoiceMeter or who use fingerprint recognition for secure access are particularly advised to delay updating until Microsoft releases patches or relevant driver updates. Microsoft has emphasized that attempting to manually install the update on affected devices could lead to functionality issues, especially for core hardware features such as sound and biometric recognition. Microsoft's temporary halt extends to certain gaming applications as well, as users have reported issues with games like Asphalt 8 and with anti-cheat software compatibility. The problems don't just affect ASUS users or specific configurations. Several Windows components essential for gaming and multimedia also experienced reduced performance or crashes during the 24H2 update. For users with custom desktops, the update has introduced display bugs for certain wallpaper applications affecting visual layouts and functionality. Microsoft is working to identify and resolve the underlying compatibility issues, aiming to provide updated drivers and patches to enable a smooth transition to 24H2. The best approach for users with affected systems is to postpone the update until compatibility fixes are released. For users encountering issues, Microsoft suggests checking the official Windows 11 support page where updates on specific hardware and software fixes will be posted. This measure is intended to ensure that users can experience a stable system with a new update without encountering critical functionality issues. Earlier this month, there was a similar issue, incompatibility issue, where certain users with select Western Digital solid-state drives were facing constant blue screens of death since they updated to the latest version of Windows. The issue pertained to the host memory buffer feature that allows the solid-state drive to use a little bit of the system's RAM to store data, speeding up performance. For those who are running Microsoft Windows 11 and has not updated to 24H2 update, hold off on it for some indefinite period of time until all issues have been resolved. There's finally a definition for open source AI. Meta has claimed its Llama models are open source, but they don't meet the Open Source Initiative's definition. The term artificial intelligence itself is so broadly applied that it can refer to everything from linear regression models to killer robots. Now, for an AI system to be considered truly open source, it must provide the following: access to details about the data used to train the AI so others can understand and recreate it, the complete code used to build and run the AI, and the settings and weights from the training which help the AI produce its results. This definition directly challenges Meta's Llama, widely promoted as the largest open source AI model. Llama is publicly available for download and use, but it has restrictions on commercial use for applications with over 700 million users and does not provide access to training data, causing it to fall short of OSI's standards for unrestricted freedom to use, modify, and share. Meta said that while we agree with our partner OSI on many things, the company disagrees with this definition. There is no single open source AI definition, and defining it is a challenge because previous open source definitions do not encompass the complexities of today's rapidly advancing AI models. We will continue working with OSI and other industry groups to make AI more accessible and free responsibly, regardless of technical definitions. But when it comes to regulating emerging technologies, clear and precise definitions are important. It's notable that following years of research and global debate, the Open Source Initiative has finally agreed on a definition for open source AI that the nonprofit organization hopes can guide international regulation. In order to be labeled open source under the new definition, an AI system, including its component code, weights, and training data, must be made freely available in such a way that anyone can, without permission, use it for any purpose, study how it works, modify it, and share with others. That's a pretty big departure from the way some tech companies have used the label amid the generative AI arms race. Most notably, Meta advertises its Llama family of models as open source because they're free to use as long as developers adhere to the company's license terms, and some of the code is publicly available. Last year, Meta also helped create a lobbying coalition called the AI Alliance to advocate for policies that benefits its particular brand of open source technologies. Llama models don't qualify as open source because their licenses still place limits on how they can be used for some commercial purposes, like improving other large language models. They also outright prohibit uses that might violate various laws or cause harm. Meta has also not fully disclosed the training data for its Llama models. The Open Source Initiative's new definition was a product of years of discussion between stakeholders from more than 35 countries, the organization said. Arriving at today's open source AI definition version 1.0 was a difficult journey filled with new challenges for the OSI community. Open Source Initiative Executive Director Stefano Mafuli said in a statement, "Despite this delicate process, filled with differing opinions and uncharted technical frontiers, and the occasional heated exchange, the results are aligned with the expectations set out at the start of this two-year process. This is a starting point for a continued effort to engage with the communities to improve the definition over time as we develop with the broader open source community the knowledge to read and apply OSAID version 1.0. While Meta cites safety concerns for restricting access to its training data, critics see a simpler motive, minimizing its legal liability and safeguarding its competitive advantage. Many AI models are almost certainly trained on copyrighted material. In April, the New York Times reported that Meta internally acknowledged that there was copyrighted content in its training data because we have no way of not collecting that. There's a litany of lawsuits against Meta, OpenAI, Perplexity, Anthropic, and others for alleged infringement. But with rare exceptions like Stable Diffusion, which reveals its training data, plaintiffs must currently rely on circumstantial evidence to demonstrate that their work has been scraped. Meta is making the same arguments as Microsoft did in the 1990s when it saw open source as a threat to its business model, a tech giant using cost and complexity to justify keeping its technology locked away. That's their secret sauce. It's the valuable IP. Rebecca Mercury is an early and tireless advocate for the necessity of transparently tabulated, voter-verified paper ballots. She has spoken before the House Science Committee, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and the Election Assistance Commission. Welcome back, Rebecca. Based on last week, I had more questions to ask you. What's the possibility of a uniform nationwide voting that has all the features that you think should be in it?
Oh, thanks very much for having me back again. Well, that's an interesting question. So why can't we demand that the entire United States all use voter-verified paper ballots and use a similar methodology for voting? Well, it happens to be states' rights. So because of states' rights, the states have their own ability to set all sorts of rules about their elections, and they do vary widely from state to state. And I think the chance of that ever happening in the United States, unless the United States becomes an autocracy or some other horrible things that I hope never happen, but no, that will never happen here because each state likes to have their own methods of voting. And maybe they could all choose the same method independently, but it's sort of like, and I hate to bring it up, but it's sort of like the abortion situation. With the abortion situation, you used to have Roe v. Wade. That would be all the states had to come under that umbrella. For voting, we don't have that, and it's sort of like what's happened now. It was thrown back to the states, and so each state chooses their own methods, and some of the methods are better or worse than others. And some of the methods are biased, as I sort of described in last week's discussion.
Well, that's, you're partially right, because to vote for president, you have to be a citizen of the United States, right? To vote for president?
And in fact, I always found that very interesting is that in New York City in particular, I found out that you do not have to be a U.S. citizen to vote for some of the local races in New York. So, but yes, in fact, I guess that's the rule for all of the United States. It's not in the Constitution. Maybe it's some other superseding law, but you won't find anything in there about that you have to be a U.S. citizen in order to vote. But at some point, I guess that became the convention. And I guess it is for president, but for the other down ballot races, whatever the state's rules are, and New York has been more liberal in that respect. Why not? Those people, roads, they need public transit, they need healthcare, and sure, why can't they vote for the things that are going on in their state or even down to the micro level as to what's going on in their city or counties?
Well, the thing is, we do have at least it's the clear election day uniform for all 50 states. Although we do have early voting, why can't we say that there are certain criteria you have to meet so that it encompasses some security in the voting itself?
Well, and again, I worked on that effort for a very long time. I don't think that every state should have to vote the exact same way. I think it is up to the states to decide how they want to vote. And some states, even as far as Election Day is concerned, you will even be hearing this on the news, is that some states allow the absentee ballots to continue to come in for a few more days. So let's say I realized, oh my goodness, I didn't send in my absentee ballot. As long as I can get it stamped and postmarked, and you need to get somebody to manually postmark it, on that day, they have to accept it. In other words, if it came in and it was passed on election day, but it didn't make it to the county for them to open and count it. So there, some states have that law. Some states say, well, you have to get it in before then. Again, in my state, we have these boxes where you can go and they're all over the place. but they're very clearly marked as election boxes, and you can put your ballots in there, and they will be taking those out, I believe, at the end of close of voting, which is 8 p.m. in New Jersey. So these are all varied, and everybody has their own custom. Oregon, every single person votes absentee. So how do they get their ballot to the place? Do they have to get them there on time? I don't know what their current laws are, but every state has its own way of voting, and I think that's okay. Those states that want to vote a certain way, they're used to that. Their citizens are used to it. Their grandparents and great-grandparents probably voted the same way as they're voting now, and they just want to keep it that way. And that's okay. But again, as I was working very closely with election officials in the various states, many various states, and also with the Federal Election Commission, okay, so I have worked closely over the course of many decades with various election officials, local, state, and even federal, and even testified in hearings before Congress and the Federal Election Commission. And the general feeling there is that if they come up with uniform rules, that they used to call them the voluntary standards or the voluntary guidelines, VVSG, I think was one of the abbreviation, voter voluntary standard guidelines or something like that. Anyway, the VVSG were these documents that people had worked on for years and years and years, and they've gotten bigger and bigger, and they're quite voluminous now with all of these rules that you have for how do you prepare voting machines, how do you create them, how do you run the election, stuff like that. But they are voluntary. So each state would have to adopt those voting system guidelines for their election. And not all states do voluntarily do that. But the problem is, and it's similar to even in aviation. So I actually, you know, I'm a computer scientist, so I was actually examining standards and guidelines for what you see in the cockpit of a aircraft. And those are very standardized, even including the typeface, the font, how the panels look. And that's important because if you're a pilot, you don't want to keep going to different planes and everything looks completely different. You want it to be standardized. And so, but these for voting are, for the FAA, those are mandatory. They can make them mandatory. For the voting systems, those are voluntary. And some of the, even some of the guidelines sort of conflict with each other. So, you know, you have a choice of you could do this, you could do that. So it's a very complicated thing. But we could reduce the complication by making sure that all voters have the opportunity to verify a paper ballot, which then could be counted afterwards, and in that method that I was referring to last week as bin sorting, you could do that, and you could actually have that all be recorded. So you can't record how people are voting, but when you get into this open room, I understand that in France they were having so much problems with voting, and they decided to go to this method. So at the end of the day in France, they just take all the ballots, dump them out on the table, they sort them out, and then they count them. Now, if you have multiple races, you have to do it multiple times, but you could just make just the presidential race, or maybe the president, the governor, and the Congress people, make those have to be manually counted. But, you know, if you've got like 40 different races, that's going to be complicated. And it also is very complicated to do it if there's, you know, like three people can get seats like in a some sort of local election. So it's like, you know, you have five to choose from and three people can be picked. It's very difficult to do that manually. You could, but I'm not recommending that. I'm recommending that you have an independent way of counting. You know, this would be secured, that you would count the certain one of N, you know, one person out of some number of choices, races, and then perhaps these other races will be done in a different way. So another way that I've always recommended is that the scanners should not be produced by voting machine companies that are, many of which are very partisan to one particular political party, in fact, and we know this for a fact, it's been going on for, you know, even back to the labor machines. But what we could do is have the scanners be open source and have a way of verifying afterwards that what was scanned actually was correct. And there are groups that are working on open source voting, and they do have these scanners, and that's the type of thing that we should really implement. Not have these scanners be closed source, be done by vendors that are particularly partisan, and that we have no way of validating. And by the way, I should just add this. In California, many people don't know that there are laws on the book that date way back, you know, like into the 1950s and stuff like this, that make it illegal to actually do a manual counting of votes. So you really want to be careful about this. If you're going to legislate that this is what should be happening, people are going to have to be looking at the laws in their particular state. I testified in a very complicated case where the two candidates had the same exact last name, and that was in California. And there were issues about, can we actually look at the ballots to see whether the ballots were done correctly or improperly. And in that particular county, you could, but in other counties, you could not. So people don't know what laws are on the books, usually until somebody goes and sues. Then there's a lawsuit, and then you find out. So it's not that easy. We can't just snap our fingers and say, okay, everybody should be, like Trump is saying, everybody should be casting their ballots on paper, and then we should be counting them by hand afterwards. It's not that simple. And really, not that I really want to talk to him, but if he wants to talk to me, I'll be happy to talk to him and any of his top aides who are, you know, who are involved with him. I would like to speak to them and explain to them that it's not a very simple thing. Okay.
Rebecca, yes. How about something more modern like internet online voting for president? We file our income tax online with the federal government, and there seems to be no problem with that. Why don't we do that with elections?
Well, you don't know that there's no problem with that. So I don't know that there's no problem with filing our income tax online. I don't file it. I give it to my accountant, and it's his problem. But I know he does file it online. So why can't we do it with elections? Because we'd like to believe that the taxes that they charge us are not controversial. Okay. So when I'm saying, okay, here's how much money I earned, and here's how much tax, now that I've computed it all down, taken all the deductions off, here's how much tax I owe you. It's not a controversy. That's the law. It's the same for everybody. You don't have any choice. Now, if you have a more expensive accountant, you might be able to get them to fudge the numbers a little bit. But, or maybe a lot, if you're Elon Musk or something like that. But as far as voting is concerned, it's controversial. So it is inherently controversial because it's people who are running against each other. And it has always been this way. That's the way it is. So we're always looking at it. It's sort of, I'm not saying warring factions per se, but they're against each other, and there can be multiple parties. And even by siphoning off votes to a third party candidate, that may be enough to reduce somebody down to where if the regular voters had voted for them, they might have won. So it is controversial, and it can be played with, and it can be monkeyed with in a whole variety of different ways. So that brings us to the internet. And so what about the internet, and what about software has been of great concern? Let's just look at the recent example of the CrowdStrike. Okay, CrowdStrike is software that is being used all over the world to run a whole bunch of different things, one of them being the airlines. How you check in, how you get your seats, how they know when to take off, how they know when to land, stuff like that. Okay, so CrowdStrike is software. I'm not saying that everybody is using it, but it's very, very popular. It's also being used with like automobile mechanics. So there was a bug in a new release of CrowdStrike that wasn't found in time. They're all supposed to be tested beforehand when they upload. And they shouldn't be uploading to everybody at the same time. That's really a very bad mistake on the part of the way CrowdStrike works. They should phase it in. Try it out in some test areas first. That way you wouldn't have a global calamity. But what happened was it took down all the airline systems. People are standing there. They couldn't get in. They're standing in the line. They couldn't get it to take their ticket, stuff like that. The whole thing just totally broke down in a major calamity. And this is happening all around the world with all of these different types of, I don't really know what to call them other than ubiquitous. It's like ubiquitous software, and it's like an ecosystem of a lot of companies have decided to all use the same software. It's sort of like our phones. You know, we have iPhones and we have Android phones. We have different phones. So depending on if there's a massive problem with iPhones, the people who have Android phones can still make calls. So, and I don't think that Apple, I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I don't think that any of these companies rolls out all their updates at the same time. In fact, I have my updates so that it has to ask me whether I want my phone to be updated. So, but if you're in a system where everybody gets updated on the same minute at one particular time on one particular day, you're going to be looking at that. And that's what we call software monocultures. It's like all of these systems are all very vulnerable at the same time. And so, no, we can't really do that with our voting systems because it would just be a target. Now, again, that was a mistake, but we don't want it to be a target for attack that could bring things down.
But Rebecca, though, not to contradict you, but there are three states or maybe more that allows internet online voting for military personnel.
And that's their prerogative if that's what they choose to do. I don't know if the military personnel also have an option. I mean, I would say that if they also have the option of mailing in their ballot early or having it, you know, shipped from wherever they are, that would be preferable rather than mandating that every single person do that. I don't think it's a good idea because the internet itself is inherently insecure and we don't really know what's going on. I mean, we all know about hacking. We all know about hospitals getting hacked and people getting bills for things that they never ordered or services that were never provided. That even happened to me. That, you know, the medical system in my area was hacked. So I don't like any of those types of things where, again, you have these clones, all sorts of things being done the same way, and then these attacks can pervasively occur throughout multiple different systems. And that's always a vulnerability. So why should we risk that when we have other things available? Nobody uses fax machines anymore, but back in the day, you could actually send faxes. Those would be hard to change, but we don't have that. So we do have internet. If you're creating a paper ballot and then somehow taking a picture of that and then sending that over the internet, probably that's not what's being done. You know, how they do it over there. I mean, there are places that people are deployed to where they don't have internet capability. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's good to have options, but I don't really see it as a very safe way to deploy voting systems.
Rebecca, thank you very much for your insight, and going to have you back after the elections to see if you may have more to say.
Sounds good.
Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and IT professionals. And one of the things that I've seen over the years, and I'll tell you, this is more of a commentary than anything else. It's not something I'm going to be able to fix. I'm going to give you some guidance along the way. But one of the things I saw a while back, now mind you, I've only interviewed in the information technology field for the past 30 years, so I haven't been involved in any of the other job hunting processes. But I get this idea, because of the way people talk, that a new thing has crept over from dealing with IT professionals and has expanded throughout all of the job hunting industry, and it's an annoyance. And I'm going to set it up like this. So back years ago, you would go in, you would apply for a job, and you would get an interview, and during that very first interview, there would be a discussion of money. And maybe even before you interviewed, they would talk about this job is X amount of dollars, Y amount of dollars, Z amount of dollars, whatever it is. This is the package we're offering. Are you interested? And they would do that all up front. Things have changed. Things have evolved, and these days I'm hearing about people who will go through multiple interviews and they will ask the question, how much does this job pay? What are the benefits? And there are people who say, well, that's a crass thing to talk about. You need to wait until we decide you're perfect for us. Well, no, not really. Not in my opinion. So if I go on out, let's say I go on out and I'm interested in buying a car. So I'm interested in a transaction that is going to involve a certain amount of money. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about computers or the car or whatever else in life. The surprise should not come at the end. I shouldn't go to a restaurant, most restaurants, and say, oh, yes, I'm interested in eating here, and they seat you. They serve you the meal. They put it all out in front of you, and then at the very end of the meal, of course, yes, we joke about the surprise at the end, but usually there's a pricing within the menu. When you walk into the restaurant, maybe they'll have the menu up there, and they'll tell you how much it is for the steak or the pasta or the chicken or a salad. How much are the desserts? They don't surprise you later because that is a waste of their time and energy and all of the work that they do to put forth all of this food for you, only to tell you that, oh, yes, this meal is going to be $3,000. Excuse me? $3,000 for a steak? It didn't have any gold on it. It's not like you offered me the entire cow. You just gave me one small little 16-ounce steak or 8-ounce steak or whatever. So the same thing should be applying here. The same thing should apply when we're talking about something that is our livelihood. I have gone through a couple of these processes where we go in and or I'll get a call. I've received phone calls and they'll say, well, you are definitely qualified. Okay, I'm great. I'm qualified for this. What is this job offering? Well, how much do you want it to offer? Excuse me? Oh, no. How much are you offering? As a matter of fact, some states have set up this exact thing. You have to tell people up front. And I love that idea. You should always know up front. There shouldn't be any of this situation where you're going through multiple interviews, you're going through an entire process, and you are tying up the time of both yourself, but the interviewer, interviewers, all of these different people getting involved, and all of a sudden they tell me, oh, hey, we're going to pay you $20 an hour. Excuse me? I'm a little bit more than that. Well, that's what we're offering. You've just taken up all of my time, all of your time to tell me that you're way below market value. Look, if you're encountering this, if you've gone on out to interview for a position and they're fighting you and telling you, hey, we're not going to discuss money, to discuss money up front is crass. No, it's not. All of this, everything about my going to work, it's not going to be about my life efforts. There's something called work-life balance. You are going to pay me a certain amount of money for me to go and spend my time, my focus with you instead of my wife, my family, my church, my retirement, whatever it is. You have to tell me what the offset is there, because the offset isn't going to be a more rewarding lifestyle being a minion for big, huge corporation X. It doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, so much of the industry has gone in that direction. Look, my advice to you, my advice to all of the IT professionals for many years has been and currently is and will probably always be, find out what that dollar amount is first. Before we go any further, before I spend 10 minutes on this, I need to know what it is. You've already seen my resume. You need to tell me what you're offering to me. You can see what I'm offering. You can see what my experience, my knowledge, what I bring to the table. What are you bringing to the table? That is my suggestion for everyone. Unfortunately, this industry is going to continue like this until something changes. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Electric pulses rejuvenate batteries. Dye electrophoresis allows dead material to recover its activity. As a battery's capacity diminishes over time, so too does its ability to store and deliver power. Repeated cycles of charging and discharging cause a substantial volumetric change in electrodes, which leads to their severe structural deformation and pulverization. This problem is worse for high-capacity electrode materials that store a large amount of energy, such as lithium and silicon. Active material constituents of such electrodes can detach over cycling time, thereby losing electrical connection to the rest of the battery components. These isolated and electromechanically inactivated components, called isolated active materials, are also often referred to as dead supply and contribute to capacity loss. In the newsletter, Science Advisor article, it reports an approach to recover isolated active materials by applying short electric pulses to the battery. This could be used to recover lost active materials in a broad range of electrode systems to extend the life of a high-capacity battery. For instance, in lithium-ion batteries, researchers have developed methods where pulses can rejuvenate the battery interface, effectively addressing fatigue and enhancing performance. Many battery maintenance devices are designed to autonomously manage the charging process while applying these rejuvenating pulses. This ensures optimal health for lead-acid batteries, making them suitable for various applications. Regular use of pulse technology can significantly prolong the effective lifespan of batteries, reducing the need for replacements. By rejuvenating old batteries, users can save money that would otherwise be spent on new batteries. Extending the life of batteries contributes to reduced waste and a lower environmental footprint associated with battery disposal. Electric pulses represent a promising approach to battery maintenance and rejuvenation, particularly for lead-acid batteries, by effectively combating sulfation and enhancing overall battery performance. Can any battery benefit from electric pulses? Electric pulses can indeed benefit various types of batteries, but the effectiveness and applicability depend on the specific battery chemistry and condition. Lead-acid batteries is particularly well-suited for rejuvenation through electric pulses. The process helps to break down the lead sulfate crystals that accumulate during discharge, effectively restoring capacity and extending the lifespan. With lithium-ion batteries, recent studies indicate that lithium-ion batteries can also benefit from pulse-charging techniques. These methods can enhance charging efficiency and potentially extend the battery's life by improving the internal chemical processes. However, the implementation of pulse charging must be carefully managed to optimize the benefits. And in nickel-cadmium batteries, similar to lead-acid batteries, NiCad batteries can experience sulfation and electric pulses may help in rejuvenating them. However, the effectiveness can vary based on the battery's condition and usage history. Rechargeable batteries can benefit from electric pulses, particularly in the context of rejuvenation and maintenance. Rechargeable batteries such as nickel metal hydride and lithium ion can experience performance degradation over time due to factors like memory effect in nickel metal hydride or capacity fade in lithium-ion batteries. Electric pulses can help mitigate these issues by refreshing the battery's internal chemistry. While many rechargeable batteries can benefit from this technique, it's essential to use appropriate devices designed for the specific battery type. Not all chargers or rejuvenators are suitable for every battery chemistry, so it's crucial to ensure compatibility to avoid damage. While many batteries can theoretically benefit from electric pulses, the results may not be as pronounced. For example, primary cells, which are non-rechargeable batteries, typically do not benefit from this technique, as they are not designed for recharging. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Speaking of crazy, that's the voice of Marty Winston. How are you this week? What do you have for us?
Animal magnetism, or maybe iPhone magnet. You're an iPhone guy. There are a lot of people who aren't. So let me talk to both camps. I know that iPhone people have only recently discovered fun with magnets.
Okay.
They got that Apple introduced the very sciencey sounding MagSafe brand for things that could magnetically stick to the back of their phones.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, candy that you've left on the counter. And many of those things are chargers. And sometimes they can both stick to the back of the phone and charge it. Imagine. Wow. Either because they're plugged into something like a USB-C port.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a hybrid. Or because they're power banks with their own batteries inside. So, you of iPhonia, can your pal with an Android phone use your MagSafe charger? The answer is not necessarily.
Okay.
Now, Rockform, R-O-K-F-O-R-M, has a pretty good MagSafe power bank. Mm-hmm. It can store 5 amp hours, delivered Q1, Qi2 charging,
okay.
Which means, you know, that's up to 7.5 watts.
Yeah.
My new phone, a Google Pixel 9 Pro XL, and when it's in the Rockform protective case, well, the charger intermittently begins charging, but over time disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you this. No Android phone can say that it's MagSafe compatible, not because it isn't, but because that's an Apple registered trademark.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will a MagSafe charger work with your Android phone? Maybe. Again, I should mention the My 2022 vintage Google Pixel charging stand can deliver a 15-watt wireless charge. But with that protective case on, my Pixel 9 loses charge.
Yeah.
Listen, if you're from iPhonia, no sweat. The Rockform cordless charger rocks.
Okay, I see what you did there.
For everybody else, the current generation Pixel phones can take charging levels beyond 7.5 watts, beyond 15 watts, mm-hmm. up to 45 watts with a direct USB-C plug-in.
Yeah.
You can bet that I'm not risking my career by not putting a case on my phone. So, in short, pick what's important to you.
What else do you have for us this week?
Oh, well, let's choose something brilliant. The Z-Wave Z Station. Now, I don't care if it's a Raspberry Pi or your monster gaming system. If it has a USB port, a gizmo I got in lets it talk to most of the home automation protocols. Z-Wave, Zigbee, Matter, Thread, BLE. This is called Z Station. It looks like a hockey puck with a pair of antennas sticking out about 30 degrees
above
horizontal. One's for the Z-Wave radio, one's for the Zigbee, which they say help give it about triple the usual range of their low-power IoT signals. So if your home automation, for example, uses projects like Home Assistant, Z-Wave JS, Zigbee 2, MQTT, OpenHAB, Domestics, FM, Node-RED, or any of several others, you may want to
port
more than a few. You may want to port your old Z-Wave network to a Z-Station. One note, those antennas are slightly under-engineered, and because of that, fragile at their hinge points.
Okay.
So treat them gently. The Z Station is about $160 plus shipping.
So how much do you have around your house that is in the home automation space these days?
I think I left 6 things still installed.
Oh, okay. So
I got rid of most of it.
So more along the lines of most the average household across the United States. I know I've gone overkill.
I know you have.
I have some 50 light switches alone that are that are automated. And that's I only shocked myself once during one of those replacements.
Well, I did learn something important this week.
Yes.
Those connectors we like that we can use instead of wire nuts and are safer to use.
Wago. I don't know how to pronounce it.
That's exactly what I learned.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Wago.
Wago. Wago. Okay.
It's from Switzerland.
Okay.
I always called them Wago. I thought, way to go.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Those are great little connectors. I love them. Every time I go into replacing one of the light switches these days, I'm outfitting the whole thing with those Wago connectors. Yeah.
Wire nuts out and Wago in.
Yeah. And it saves space. And they are far more reliable than those wire nuts. Oh, far more.
Tug it once when you first use it. What you may not know, and I think you know if the others don't, I've been designing a product for production.
Yeah.
And I'm using that connector and some like it in a wire-to-board version.
Okay.
And as a result, I don't have to crimp or stake cable ends on.
Nice.
Push it in and it clamps until I poke a little thing to release it.
Okay.
Now, not all of them are Wago. Some of them are Wago. Some are from other makers. But they are so innovative in places people will never see unless you void your warranty.
I got no problem with that. Magnuson Moss Warranty Act. We'll talk about that another time. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, November the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. TED Ed Connect meets Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and is Zoom only because the library is unavailable for Election Day. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is wpcug.org. Kingsbite Computer Club meets Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, and the number to confirm is 347-278-7320. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation, Voting Systems 2024, Was the Election Stolen? It will be presented by Rebecca Mercury. Thursday, November the 14th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Digital Wallets, Exploring the Future of Payments. The meeting is Thursday, November the 28th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. A reminder that daylight saving time ends this weekend for most of us. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.